And I pray, Lord, that you would be glorified in our thoughts and in our words today. And I pray that you give us clarity of thought, that you enable me to articulate the true biblical position in this area. And I pray that you open hearts and minds to receive your truth, and that you would help us and strengthen us so that we can use this in our dialogues with non-believers. So I pray that you would confirm the faith of believers, but also allow us to use this information to plant seed and lead others to Christ. In Jesus' precious name we pray. Amen. Okay, in case you don't know, I'm Phil Fernandez. I head the Institute of Biblical Defense. That's my wife, Kathy, in the back there. And Eric asked that I would just speak briefly about moral relativism, and then just kind of open it up to the floor for questions. And so pretty much there's two key phrases, if you will, that we have to get down before we even begin to discuss this issue. There's moral absolutism, which is the belief in moral absolutes. In other words, there are some moral laws that are true for all people at all times and in all places. Okay, the Bible contains many moral absolutes. The Bible also, though, contains some moral laws from God that were just temporary, like animal sacrifices for the nation of Israel. So just because there's a command in the Bible doesn't mean it's a moral absolute. We've got to, you know, look real close to see if it is one of God's moral commands that applies to all people at all times and in all places. Moral relativism is just basically the rejection of moral absolutism. So, in other words, moral relativism would argue that there's no objective, universal, or absolute moral values. No moral values that are true for all people, at all times, in all places. And by the way, I might even remove the word objective, no objective, universal moral values. You might even want to remove the word objective, because a lot of atheists now are claiming that they hold to objective moral values. You tell them, well, you reject absolute moral values, you reject universal moral values, and they say, no, I don't. I hold to objective moral values. But so there's a way that they're trying to explain how there can be no God and we can have moral values that exist outside of human minds and have some objective basis. At the same time, they're camouflaging that, because it really doesn't mean absolute universal moral values. Michael Martin did that to me in our debate over the internet. And by the way, there's two directions that why this is moral relativism, why it is so important for Christians, especially Christians who are in a non-Christian or an anti-Christian environment, like a university campus where you share your faith. The two reasons is because you can argue either direction. A person can be an atheist and just recognize, well, if there's no God, then it makes sense that there's no moral laws. So some atheists are moral relativists just because they reject God's existence, and they see that that's a result of being an atheist. However, some people are atheists because they already do reject moral laws. No universal moral laws, therefore no God. And in fact, one of the Huxleys admitted that the only reason why he denied God's existence was he wanted to do his own thing. And if he admits that God exists, he has to also adhere to God's program and God's laws. And he didn't want it. He wanted to do his own thing. So he said, well, because I believe there's no moral laws, that's why I believe there's no God. And then he says, then as a, you know, an agnostic or an atheist, I then spend the rest of my life trying to find evidence to disprove God because I don't want his moral values. Well, some guys throw God out first, and then they recognize moral values go out with them. Others throw out the moral laws first, and then they realize that God goes with it. Every once in a while, you'll have an atheist who's trying to hold the absolute existence of absolute universal moral values, that somehow they just come with the furniture of the universe. And my response to the atheist there is, well, then atheism is not an explanation of the way things are. It's a non-explanation. Bertrand Russell, in his debate against Frederick Copleston asked him, how do you explain the origin of the universe? And Russell said, we should say it's just there. Well, if someone denies God's existence but believes in real, universal, absolute moral values, then what they're saying is those moral values are just there. And then atheism no longer is an explanation, it's a non-explanation. Okay? So, if this is universe without God, the moral lawgiver, it only makes sense that it's a universe without moral laws. So basically, the idea that there's no universal moral laws, that's what moral relativism is. Each person decides what is right for himself. That's it in its purest form. Now, there have been many different adaptions made to moral relativism because that's a very weak position. You know, for instance, pretty obvious, if each person decides what is right for himself, then we've got no right to call Adolf Hitler wrong. But even atheists and agnostics want to call Adolf Hitler and his actions wrong. So there's been a few changes there. But let me just throw at you a few atheist thinkers, those who deny God's existence or at least doubted the existence of God. They were pretty much all atheists, though they might have watered down their claims so they wouldn't have to prove as much. But basically, let me just throw four of them out at you. First, Friedrich Nietzsche, lived from 1844 to 1900, was a German philosopher. If you get a chance to read Nietzsche's works, you can get all of his work in the Portable Nietzsche, one book translated by Walter Kaufman. But the thing is, you got to read his stuff really close because he liked to write in a creative style. So instead of just coming out and saying, I do not believe that God exists, and the leaders of Western thought do not believe that God exists, he says, he gives a parable about a madman running through the town screaming, God is dead, God is dead. You know, and I'm a man before my time. You guys don't even realize that God is dead. Can't you hear the sound of the grave diggers throwing dirt over his head? And what he's basically telling them is, we all know that God is dead, that the Christian religion has died, that God no longer exists. Nietzsche thought that the atheists of his day had outgrown that Neanderthal belief, but his problem was that his atheist colleagues were still living like God was still alive, like Christianity was still a viable option for thinkers in Western culture. And what he was saying is, if God is dead, then traditional values have died with him. If God is dead, then you can take the Ten Commandments and throw them out the window. You can take the traditional values taught in the Scriptures and throw them out. So what he's saying is, you guys admit that Christianity is false, but you don't live like it's false. Nietzsche rejected the soft values of Christianity because he believed that they stifle human creativity, and he recommended hard values. He glorified things like war, and he wanted a group of supermen to arrive on the scene through their will to power to have the courage to create their own set of hard values and basically force them on everybody else. And because of that, he predicted that the 20th century would be the bloodiest century in the history of mankind, which 20th century has proven him correct. Okay, but it would be Western culture, man come of age, realizing the implications of a universe without God. Without God, there are no more absolute moral values. Man is free to create his own moral values. And so what Nietzsche is basically saying is, if there is no God, the result is nihilism, no meaning to life, no moral values, no value to human life, no absolute truth. At the same time, Nietzsche knew man couldn't live there, and so he came up with his own myth, the myth of the Superman, to replace what he thought was the myth of Christianity, okay? But I do think that Nietzsche was the most consistent atheist who ever lived, which may explain why he died insane. Others would argue that it might have been syphilis that caused his insanity, but whatever the case, he was not a happy camper when he died. But I do think that he tried to live consistently with his worldview more than any other atheist. Bertrand Russell was a British philosopher, lived from 1872 to 1970. This is a quote from Russell from one of his essays that is today in his Why I Am Not a Christian. He stated this: outside human desires, there is no moral standard. So what is right and what is wrong is totally determined by human desires. There isn't this absolute moral law that exists, an objective universal standard that exists above all mankind. You know, the question comes up, what if a person desires to kill the innocent? You know, and he tried to wrestle in his debate with Copleston. By the way, it's still in print, I believe. It's usually an extra chapter, Bertrand Russell's debate against Father Copleston, the Jesuit priest. And Copleston was also a philosophical giant. He has a History of Philosophy, the 9-volume set that is still the standard work in its field. But in that debate, Copleston pinned down Russell to where Russell said that, well, basically, a person could be, just as we have colorblind people, a person's desires could be messed up, and they could be mistaken, like an Adolf Hitler in the area of morality. And Copleston just kept hammering that only makes sense if there really is a color green, and if there really is a color yellow, and this guy's getting mixed up. In other words, it only makes sense if there is an absolute standard. And Russell kept dancing and dancing. Bertrand Russell was one of the most brilliant people of our century, except when he attacked Christianity. Then he sounded like, to me, he sounded like a third grader with an attitude. It sounded like, you know, a little kid in a schoolyard argument, where they're just trying to be nasty and say mean things about each other's mommy. It's just amazing how inconsistent he was once he tried to attack Christianity. By the way, Russell's entire life was inconsistent. He protested war, fought for equal rights for homosexuals, and the question comes up, why? If there is no absolute moral standard, why are you condemning people for violating it? A.J. Ayers lived from 1910 to 1989. This guy's interesting because right before he died, he had two near-death experiences, which sounded very much like evidence for God's existence, but he just, you know, denied. But he felt like he was moving towards light, and he felt like all the deeds he had ever done were being observed. He felt like he was being judged by the judge of the universe. This is an atheist talking, and so it's really interesting. But he also is a British philosopher, and he argued that moral commands merely express a person's subjective feelings. So again, morality is just what comes from each individual. Each individual decides for himself. There's no standard above all others. Jean-Paul Sartre was a French existentialist, lived from 1905 to 1980. He argued that there was no objective meaning to life. He argued if there's no God, then there's no moral values. There's no such thing as absolute truth, no meaning to life. But then he argued, as human beings, we desperately need meaning in life. And so Jean-Paul Sartre argued that we must therefore take a leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm and create our own values, which, you know, I think it begs the question, if there really is no meaning to life, why even do that? And that this was hard for even followers of Sartre to accept. That's why Timothy Leary said, well, wouldn't it be easier if we induced our existential leap through LSD trips? And then the Beatles read his writings, and the rest is history. But basically what you have with these four atheists, there is agreement in two things, and one of those things is that there is no God, And the second thing they agree on, since there is no God, there's no such thing as absolute universal moral commands, moral laws. If there is no absolute moral lawgiver, there's no absolute moral laws. There are no absolute moral laws. So they were in agreement there. Now, you will get some atheists who will argue, like I said, in the opposite direction. There's no moral laws. We don't want anybody telling us what to do. There's no moral laws. Therefore, there's no God. And so some could argue in the other direction. And once in a while, you will find an atheist who tries to say no God, but somehow moral laws do exist. But I think that's a very weak position to hold, especially since moral laws are prescriptive. They're not descriptive. Descriptive laws, like the law of gravity, the first and second laws of thermodynamics, they're descriptive. They're natural laws. They're descriptive. They describe the way things are. They describe the way the universe operates. Okay? But a moral law is a command. It is a prescriptive law. It prescribes the way things ought to be. And it prescribes the way we ought to act. Just like a prescription drug, in order to get it, you have to have the signature of the prescriber, the doctor. Okay? And so it's pretty obvious if somebody doesn't want the moral laws, they wouldn't want God. If somebody doesn't want God, they wouldn't want the moral laws. And if somebody does believe that there is no God, but there are absolute universal moral laws, there is a tremendous inconsistency there. It begs the question, well, where did they come from? And, you will have some atheists who try to argue that through physical evolution, through randomness, given enough time, you eventually humans will evolve some type of immaterial aspects. And so you have some really weird ideas. I don't think there's really, in an atheistic universe, I really don't think there's any room for spiritual invisible entities, if you will. It just doesn't make sense to me. In fact, even Augustine, who was Platonic in his thought, he followed Plato in a lot of his philosophy, he agreed with Plato that these eternal, unchanging ideas do exist. But he said the problem with Plato was they're just hanging there. But Augustine said, we Christians know where they reside. Those eternal, unchanging ideas reside in the eternal, unchanging mind of God. Okay? So in other words, you can think of a very creative thought tomorrow, and you might even be the first human who ever came up with that thought. But the fact of the matter is, God knew that thought throughout all eternity. In one eternal, we think one thought at a time. God knows everything that ever will be known, everything that can be known in one eternal thought, one eternal glance. Of course, the problem with moral relativism is that when a person denies the absolute moral law, they cannot consistently condemn the actions of another person as evil. Okay, they contradict what they said. In fact, most moral relativists, whenever you say, that was wrong what you did, Harry, a moral relativist will correct you and will say, hey, look, that's not true because there are no such things as right and wrong. Therefore, you were wrong to tell that guy he was wrong. See, it's most of the time when moral relativism is thrust into your face, it's so that a person can judge your actions as wrong for calling their actions or anybody else's actions wrong. And that's inconsistent. A moral absolutist can say, hey, I think what you're doing is wrong. And there's nothing inconsistent with that. Robert Emerson, who teaches at Olympic College, wrote this book, Theologians Under Hitler. And he argues there that Christianity led to the Holocaust. If we don't want another Holocaust, we've got to do something about Christianity. He doesn't come right out and say what he wants to do, but I suspect he would like our property confiscated, like what occurred to the Jews in Nazi Germany. Eventually, he would probably like us in detention camps somewhere, and the rest follows logically from that. And he's misdiagnosing the problem. The problem was the leadership of the German church apostatized from the faith, and that removed that restraining influence that the church has on its society, and that opened the door for an Adolf Hitler. But Erickson, throughout his book, calls himself a moral relativist. It was published by Yale Press, so it's not a fly-by-night book. In fact, he tours Europe. That is the standard view in Europe, is that the Holocaust was our fault. And as anti-Christian as America is getting, it's nowhere near where Europe is. And we're heading in that direction, but they're further off than we are. But anyway, he calls himself a moral relativist in that book over and over again, yet time and time again in that book he calls Adolf Hitler's actions wrong. And I told him, I challenged him publicly to debate me on two different occasions, and he turned it down, and I can see why, because his positions are so weak to defend. But I asked him after one of his talks that he gave, I said, in my worldview, I can call Adolf Hitler's actions wrong, because I believe in moral absolutes. But you say you're a moral relativist. He said, I am. And I said, well, then how can you call Hitler wrong and be consistent with your view? That's a contradiction. He said, he smiled, he said, I know, but I can live with it. And then he walked away. And so, he doesn't have to tell that to his students, but they will find out if he debates a moral absolutist. So he just stays away from those debates, and he leaves that little chuckle, that little one-liner at the end. But basically what he's saying is the political correctness movement is actually product of postmodernism, rejection of absolutes, and you decide what you believe not based on rational evidence. You decide what you believe based on your feelings, and then if enough people in positions of power feel like believing what you believe, then you end up with political correctness where you cram that down everybody else's throat. And so what you end up having is taxpayers' money will pay professors to badmouth Christianity, and Christian professors are, there's not a whole lot of money coming in, and so in the end you end up with a lot more of these guys in a lot more positions of power than these guys, and you hear one message over and over again, and eventually it changes an entire population, the view of them. But anyway, just to condemn the actions of another person as evil, some type of absolute standard must be resurrected in order to make that value judgment. So it's how many people here have read Humanist Manifestos 1 and 2? It's very, very short, very small. They're basically a bunch of atheists got together in 1933, and then later on in 1973, the next generation of them did. And they basically explained how no deity is going to save the planet. We must save ourselves. There is no God. We've got to get beyond Christianity and all these fairy tales. But when they talk about moral values, I can't remember if it's Humanist Manifesto number 1 or number 2, they say that basically human values are autonomous. In other words, each person decides what is right for himself. No one else can decide for them. Just a paragraph later, they contradict themselves, and they say that and by the way, the guys who signed this thing, you talk to people like John Dewey and B.F. Skinner, and you're talking the big guns in the world of atheism. But after saying that human values are autonomous, everybody decides for themselves, just a paragraph later, they state that they are for any sexual practice between two consenting adults. Now, that doesn't sound like a contradiction until you break down what they're saying. When they say that they're not against any sex between two consenting adults, it's a veiled way of saying that they are against certain sexual acts, i.e. rape, where one of the parties is not consenting, and sex with children. Okay? The thing is, Christians can be consistent and condemn those actions. But a moral relativist cannot be, and that's exactly where the secular humanists place themselves. So they like to say, well, there are no such thing as these universal moral values, but then to live in the real world, they have to resurrect some Christian world values. They've got to go to Mount Zion and pull at least one of the tablets down from God and bring it back into the picture. So it's like Francis Schaeffer said, oh, how many people here have read Francis Schaeffer? He's got some dynamite works, and his works, some people are saying his works are outdated. They are not. He was dealing with European thinkers which means back in the late 70s, he was 40 to 80 years ahead of where American thought is going to be. So Schaefer's still going to be current the year 2020, 2030, but at least in America. But whatever the case, he showed over and over again, you can deny the Creator, but you still have to live in His creation. So you still have to live like Christianity is true. And so basically, if moral relativism is true, there's no basis from which to condemn the actions of an Adolf Hitler. I remember I saw a television debate. It was out of New York, so this rabbi had a Jewish rabbi and an Orthodox rabbi and a homosexual were debating about whether or not homosexuals should teach in the public schools, should be allowed to teach in the public schools. And this rabbi had a New York, heavy Brooklyn accent, and it had that little Jewish touch to it, so it was, I really enjoyed watching it. And during this debate, the homosexual asked the rabbi, what problem do you have with homosexuality? And the rabbi said, because it's wrong, because it's a sin. And the homosexual said, you can't say that, you're making a moral value judgment. So the homosexual was assuming that moral relativism has been proven, and it is an injustice to reject moral relativism, which again is a contradiction. But the rabbi just smiled, and he just held his hand up, and I thought, man, why didn't he respond? So then the rabbi read from an article where a homosexual not only wanted the right to teach in the public schools, but he also wanted the right to have sexual relations with some of the male students. Well, the homosexual that he was debating got upset and says, well, I disagree with that guy, so don't throw that, that's not my view. And so the rabbi said, well, why do you disagree with him? And the homosexual said, because he's wrong. And then the rabbi pointed at him and shook his head and said, but you can't make moral value judgments. And, you know, what could the homosexual say? And, you know, if this is the only thing you remember today, try to remember this. A worldview, a system of beliefs, a worldview that cannot be consistently lived, that cannot be consistently applied, is not worth believing. We've got to stop kidding ourselves and you know, espousing beliefs that we just cannot live in accordance with. And modern man, you know, we think we've come so far, but some of the worldviews that we are entertaining right now, ancient man would have just found it comical. But we all recognize, we might not recognize evil, we don't see evil real clearly when we are the ones who want to do the evil. Okay? But when we are wronged, we see evil very clearly, you know, because we tend to be selfish, so we don't think about other people's rights, but we do think about our own rights. That's why Jesus didn't say, do to others, you know, treat others the way you know they should be treated. Because then we would still treat others like trash rather than like human beings created in God's image. So Jesus said, knowing how selfish we are, Jesus said, do to others what you would have them do to you. The way you want to be treated. See, we have in our conscience, we have a glimpse of God's moral commands, okay? And that glimpse gets real clear when we think and talk about our own rights. But when we talk about other people's rights and how we should treat them, then it gets all of a sudden, it gets foggy again. But whatever the case, we all recognize actions as evil when we are wronged. Romans 2:14 and 15 tells us, by the way, that even non-Jews, even Gentiles, who don't have God's commands written on tablets of stone, have God's laws written in their hearts, on their consciences. Basically, I'll just close with this argument for the absolute moral law. The moral law, I touched on this last Saturday, the moral law doesn't originate with the individual, because if it does, then we could not call the actions of another person wrong. I.e., Adolf, we wouldn't be able to call Adolf Hitler's actions wrong if each person decides what is right and what is wrong, if there is no standard above the individual. So then others argue, well, maybe a few individuals get together and the moral law is created by a society, a collection of people. The problem with that is if the moral law is created by the society, then one society cannot call the actions of another society wrong. So America would have no higher standard to appeal to, no moral law above both America and Nazi Germany to condemn the actions of Nazi Germany. Now, others would argue that it comes from a world consensus. If we know anything, we know that the world consensus is not perfect, it's not infallible. The world consensus used to be, you know, you go way back in time, the world consensus was that the world was flat, that we live in a geocentric universe where the sun revolves around the earth rather than the other way around. We thought that slavery was right and that the woman was the property of the man. In all these things, both Christians and non-Christians agree the world was world consensus was mistaken in the past. So if it was mistaken in the past, it could be mistaken today. And another problem would be, how do you really get world consensus? It's not the most popular views that are enforced. It's usually the loudest views that are enforced. Okay? Whoever has the most money for the political ads is probably going to win the election, because they're going to, turn a good guy into a Darth Vader by the time you go to the polls or whatever. But whatever the case, world consensus, society, all these are doing is quantitatively adding more and more individuals. That's not what is needed. What is needed is a moral law that is qualitatively above man. Okay, you see what I'm getting at? The authority doesn't come by adding more individuals. It has to stand above all men. The other thing is, too, is even atheists like to protest for world progress. They want to move us in the right direction. They want us to stop doing the evils of the past, and they want the world of today and tomorrow to be better. The problem with that is, if we condemn the actions of the past, then this standard that's qualitatively above man must be eternal and unchanging. We're implying a standard that remains the same throughout the passage of time. Okay? So now, if you have a moral law that is eternal and unchanging and exists above all men, then basically what you're going to need is a moral... Remember, these laws are prescriptive, not descriptive, so you need a prescriber. You basically need a moral lawgiver who is qualitatively above all mankind, and this moral lawgiver must be eternal and unchanging to be an adequate explanation of eternal and unchanging moral laws which exist above all mankind. So that's about all I have. I'll open it up to questions, but before I do that, I just remind you, you might already have them. You might not even be interested in them, but whatever the case... I have my two books here, The God Who Sits Enthroned, Evidence for God's Existence. We're selling that for $5. And then we have No Other Gods, A Defense of Biblical Christianity, which defends not only God's existence, but the deity of Christ, His resurrection, things of that sort. And we're selling this for $10, but if you buy both, you can get them both for $12. And so if you have some interest in that, you might want to pick them up before you leave today. You might have a friend who might be interested in them. That's fine. And if you don't feel led to get them, that's fine too. Don't worry about that. I just want to make that available so we have some follow-up materials. In fact, I believe we have a chapter on moral relativism. Yeah, refuting moral relativism in the blue book, what we talked about today. But at this point, I'll just open it up to the floor for any questions, any observations that you have, anything that you'd like to share. And Francis Schaeffer, I think, was a great thinker. An awful lot of his... He was trained. He did have a 3-year Master of Divinity degree, but he didn't have a PhD in philosophy and that type of thing. A good portion of what he learned, of his thought, he actually gained through conversations with non-believing thinkers. And so basically what I'm saying is Campus Crusade for Christ staffers, student leaders, students who are Christians that share their faith, there's a world of information and knowledge that you can get through experience. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't really care how a person got educated. What matters to me is that the person knows what they're talking about, but you can learn a lot from experience, from getting out there in the front lines and That's where Francis Schaeffer learned his thought, was in the trenches. So don't feel that you have to ask a question. If you've got something that you would like to share, that you've learned by experience or from reading some works, go right ahead. Specifically, we'd like to stay on this topic, but if there's something else that has to do with sharing your faith or defending the faith, you can bring up a question in that area as well. So, usually the first question is the toughest to ask. So,
what is the consequences of rejecting moral absolutes?
Yeah, one of the consequences of rejecting moral absolutes, and it's pretty obvious, is that the person is implying that they're ultimately, there is no court that they are accountable to, that ultimately they're answerable to no one. Now, they might say that, you know, like Sigmund Freud was a moral relativist, but he did not believe it was wrong to rape someone, but he believed it would be a foolish decision because the authorities would probably catch you and punish you. So moral relativists will often say, yeah, there are, you know, earthly powers that you don't want to upset. At the same time, if you can get away, if you can manage to do what you feel like doing without getting in trouble with them, there is no, you know, there's obviously no ultimate eternal court, no eternal judge that would judge your actions. And so basically, it's like in the Brothers Karamazov, the novel, I think one of the brothers there states, if there is no God, all things are permissible. And so basically, if it feels good, do it, you know, that kind of thing. And I'll tell you, there's some weird people, even in this country. You go back east and there's guys that enjoy hitting people. So you better hope that the guy, if he's believes if it feels good, do it. You better hope that he has enough respect for the governing authorities, or he's just not consistent with his views, because Hitler thought the best thing possible for this planet was to weed out the genes of any non-Aryans, and the easiest way to do that was to basically get rid of anybody who didn't fit his definition of the ideal man. And so, I'm thankful that there is a God, and that this God does sit enthroned, and that this God has spoken, and that he has told us what is right and what is wrong, so that even if we can't overpower an Adolf Hitler, the least we can do is to condemn his actions and to call it wrong. And it amazes me at how many people don't believe in such a thing as right and wrong, that speak out against the atrocities of the past. Because they're acting a lot like Christians when they do. And it's really crazy, though. You want to throw God out the window and condemn Hitler for his actions. As time goes on, each decade, we begin to, our behavior gradually changes, where each decade we start looking more and more. The American culture begins to do things that we condemn Nazi Germany for doing. And we don't even see the inconsistency. I mean, right now, if you don't believe that a woman and a doctor have the right to kill a baby who's 2/3 out of the mother's womb, you're called an extremist. Nobody was using that argument in the 1940s at the Nuremberg trials, when they were condemning the Nazis for doing exactly that type of thing. But sometimes I don't read nonverbal communication, so you can scratch your head or just move an arm.
This question goes to my mind. It's a question of a very short story and ask the question again. Why is it that it's so difficult for relativists to see the inherent contradictions in their philosophy?
Mm-hmm.
Situation a number of years ago, Cliff Connectly, traveling speaker with Intervelocity, comes here almost every year. Hundreds of people out in front of the hub on the lawn. He's talking about moral relativism. I hear some students saying, okay, here comes our professor. And apparently this guy was a very outspoken atheist in his philosophy class this year. steps to the front of the crowd, challenges Cliff, mm-hmm. and you hear a pin drop on the grass, mm-hmm. and that's quiet. And he's just going through the juggler, and Cliff graciously just lets him fall.
Yeah.
And then he asks him, sir, he says, there's no more us, everything's relative, there's no truth. When he's done, Cliff said, asks him, says, sir, what are your views on apartheid? And
yeah.
It's still in its heyday.
Yeah.
And he just, evil, it's wrong. And he asks the same question.
Yeah.
But based on what you said, how can you say that? Is that not you just pushing your moral beliefs on them? And the professor could not answer.
Yeah.
What happened was he got all angry, cursed, and just stormed out of the crowd.
Yeah.
And so I'm sitting there thinking, this is so simple. Here's a guy with a PhD, and he never asked himself that question.
Yeah.
So my question is it simply a spiritual thing that there are blinders on them? Why is it so? Why have they not seen the contradiction?
Yeah. The question, just for the cassette, is basically. Moral relativism is from beginning to end contradictory. Why don't these intelligent PhD philosophers see their contradictions? And I would say a couple things. One thing is that chapter that I have in the No Other Gods book, the appendix on Blaise Pascal. Pascal did not throw reason out the window. He believed man is a rational being. What he disagreed with Descartes on, his countrymen, his fellow Frenchmen, was that Descartes, man was a rational being, period. Pascal said man is a rational being, but he's more than just a rational being. He has intuition. He just knows some things, some self-evident truths, without having any evidence for them. He has a will, emotions. There's so many things that influence the decisions that we make that sometimes reason is in the background. It's not in the forefront. It's not the... So... We like to think of ourselves as being so rational and only accepting where the evidence will take us, but in reality, an awful lot of the decisions that we make are based upon passion. In fact, Pascal would argue that you can get the best thinker in town. If there's a bug flying around his head when you're preaching, what you're saying is going in one ear and out the other. He's more concerned about the bug. That's enough to trip up his reason to where he is not going to be rational enough to really receive what you're saying. So that's one way to respond. The other way is, I think when this was first being proposed, I think moral relativists, at least in modern times, I think that a lot of moral relativists assumed that maybe they just didn't know how to reconcile that with the law of non-contradiction and absolute truth, and they really didn't heed the warnings of Nietzsche. That if God goes, not only do moral values go, but the whole idea of absolute truth goes. But I think what we need to acknowledge is that postmodernism actually prides itself in what they believe the modernist would view as a contradiction. They pride themselves in holding to those contradictions. They think the modernist is mistaken, which again is a contradiction, because if there is no absolute truth, there is no such thing as mistakes. So, you know, everything is just as true, and everything is has the same status of falsity. I mean, in fact, truth and falsity are illusory. So, so whatever the case, it is actually popular. Sometimes, okay, let's say you said that was a first-year student and he got all upset at this apologist who was speaking, a defender of the Christian faith that you mentioned, and the professor got all upset at him, but let's say the professor wasn't a professor, he was a first-year student. Then I would say, well, it's just possible that the reason why he's attacking the man, it's an ad hominem fallacy, attacking the man rather than the man's argument. You could say maybe it's because he doesn't know enough about his position. And so, rather than admit to defeat, he's lashing out. But if the guy's got a PhD, he's a big-time professor on the campus, it's probably not a lack of information. There probably is no response. And I think it's safe to say, and we see this in political debates today with the political correct movement, if people choose their beliefs not by rational evidence, but by their feelings and their emotions, then they're not going to be able to defend them. through rational evidence, they're probably going to defend them through personal attacks and emotional outbursts. And that's exactly what you see there. Actually, I think the moral relativist, what he's actually doing, they don't even have to mention any names, but it's an appeal to authority. Remember, we Christians would always get slammed because Galileo, who happened to be a professing Christian, they don't mention that, but he got slammed by this infallible pope for saying that the earth revolves around the sun. But the funny thing is they don't even agree with each other. So, you got guys going to quantum physics to try to prove that the universe doesn't really need an absolute beginning, but there is no standard theory of agreement in the field of quantum physics. I mean, there's so many different views, they all contradict one another. So, but whatever the case, I think when everything's said and done, it's an appeal to authority. You know, the four big guns that I mentioned, Nietzsche, Russell, Ayers, Sartre, it's like saying, you know, don't you know that all the leading philosophers today don't believe in God and don't believe in absolute moral values? That's what the argument boils down to. Creation versus evolution, that's what the argument boils down to. Don't you know the leading scientists today are evolutionists? And that sounds a lot like some guy, you know, four centuries ago saying, well, the infallible pope has spoken, therefore let's stop thinking about the issue. Our minds have been made up by him. And whatever the case, it's almost like, yeah, you can throw out all these contradictions, but Russell was a genius, he agreed with me. Sartre was a genius, he agreed with me. And you can't name any big name philosopher that's living today, but you know, in that two things to respond to there. If you are a world class philosopher like William Lane Craig, and you are a Christian like Craig is, automatically you're not part of the big name philosopher social club. Automatically you get dropped down to the level of the Neanderthals, because those are, you know, the anti Christians are the guys with the power right now. Secondly, I think you can show that non-theists, those who deny the existence of a personal God, the 20th century is an aberration in the history of philosophy. And we're starting to see that right now, that usually your philosophy professor or the chairman of the philosophy department is an atheist. However, all the young guys that are getting hired as assistant professors and associate professors are usually a lot closer to pantheism, or are at least postmodernists who are open to mysterious spiritual explanations that the head of their departments are not open to. And so as soon as those guys die out, the atheist dinosaurs die out, the question isn't going to be, is there a God? The question is going to be, which God is the true God? But if you look at the history of philosophy, though not all the great philosophers were Christians, a very high percentage of them, Plato, Aristotle, the Christian philosophers, even guys like Immanuel Kant, David Hume, most of the great thinkers that these guys, the atheists, turned to for their arguments against Christianity still did believe in the existence of a personal God. It was never considered throughout the history of philosophy, atheism or agnosticism were never considered rational world views because they lacked the explanatory power. It's only in this century that the history of philosophy has scooped to that level. And you know, if the Lord's return is not in the very near future, the 20th century may be viewed as a tremendous embarrassment to the history of philosophy, that guys could actually entertain the idea that we randomly got here from primordial soup. But any other questions?
How about the view of our great Chinese philosophers hold that there is a moral standard, but the moral standard follows nature, so we don't need to have God.
Yeah, and the question there, very good question about the great Chinese philosopher. Are you talking about Confucius, or are you talking about just philosophers? Lao Tzu and basically arguing that there is an absolute moral standard, basically, although it does not have to be anchored in God. And, you know, basically, I'm in agreement with him that there is an absolute moral standard. My response to that great thinker of the past would be, why? You know, where do these absolute moral laws come from? For instance, absolute moral law, do no harm to another. Can you take that? Is that moral law real? Lao Tzu would say, yeah, it's real. Well, you know, can you bounce it? Can you throw it? How much does it weigh? So it's pretty much not a physical thing. It's an invisible thing, but it's still real. It doesn't take from the reality of it. So my question is, well, where do these invisible real things called moral values come from? My answer is the invisible, eternal, unchanging mind of God. So others that just put them there are kind of like Plato, where they've got these eternal, unchanging moral values, the invisible world of the forms or the ideas, if you will, but they're just hanging there, and they're there without an explanation. So my response would be, well, you know, it's basically what philosophers say, it begs the question. Somebody said, well, they're just there. Why? Why are they there? You know, and philosophy is supposed to be a search for explanations, a search for the reasons why things are the way they are. And it just seems to me that if a man honestly makes that search, he always ends up in the throne room of God, and a lot of people don't like hanging out there. So we don't always go where the evidence leads us. And so sometimes we say, well, yeah, there's absolute moral values, and then we walk into the throne room of the absolute moral value, absolute moral law giver. We don't like being there, so then we have two options. Either throw out the absolute moral values and pretend they don't exist until somebody wrongs you, or admit that they do exist, but just stop our search for truth at that point. Don't go any further. That's what Bertrand Russell was trying to get us to do when he said the universe is just there. So I would agree with that great Chinese tradition that there are moral values. I would just ask the question, why? And I think ultimately the big explanation is, you know, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and part of the heavens and the earth are these things, you know, moral values that flow from his mind. Actually, the moral values aren't even created, they naturally flow from his nature throughout all eternity. But okay, any other questions? I thought I saw another hand that was up at one time. Okay, I don't know if you want to just open it up to just informal fellowship or that type of thing, but would you like to close in prayer?
Heavenly Father, we thank you for talking to me. Just some questions ask and answer and these kinds of things. And Father, I really ask that you can heal the individual of our souls and teach them about who you are and how to be honest with you. Thank you for your time.
Amen.